Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement, which is a national grassroots movement of sexual and gender-based violence survivors and allies coming together to highlight the stories that the mainstream media refuses to touch. I do want to give a brief warning and a trigger warning, content warning, and viewer discretion is advised. The topics at hand that will be discussed during this specific episode can be triggering to some audiences. Again, viewer discretion is advised. Today, I am sitting down with Deanna Merrifield's sister. 35 years after the disappearance of Deanna Merrifield, when she was just 13 years old, when she disappeared in 1990 from her grandmother's home in Killeen, Texas. 35 years later, the family and the sister is still searching for answers. Deanna was a bright, sweet, and protective girl growing up in Killeen, Texas, the second of four daughters. She was known for her love of She-Ra, bike rides, and exploring creeks near her home. Today, I am joined by Melissa. Melissa,
Hello.
thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. And I am
Thank you for having me.
absolutely. And I think let's just dive in. Share with us, how was Deanna growing up? Walk us through going to school, walk us through, and you're her younger sister, right?
Right. That's right.
So walk us through what just walk us through your earliest memories and walk us through what led up to it. The floor is yours.
Okay, so I'm Melissa. I am Deanna's young, little sister. There were four of us girls, our oldest sister, and Deanna and her twin, and then myself. We grew up in Killeen, Texas. Our mom was a single mother when we were really little. And then she met our stepfather, Roy, when I was about three or four. Growing up was, I prefer to remember the good parts. And growing up with Deanna, especially, what she loved watching She-Ra. So watching She-Ra with her and, exploring the creeks, like you mentioned, we used to go out. There was a creek by our house and we would always explore over there and, catch crawdads with bologna, things like that. And Deanna was really, really smart and she was very protective of me. Us being four girls in the house, there were bound to be fights and arguments and things like that. But Deanna, I feel like, always tried to help me as far as that went. It wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Our mother was an alcoholic, but I don't remember that part of her when we were really young. But she was, and she married our stepfather, Roy, in 1986 when I was about seven. And, Deanna had always done really well in school and was in the gifted program, and then things started to change, and Deanna started not doing so great in school, and that was around fifth grade. And our mom was starting to get sick from her alcoholism. So in 1989, our mother was, it was the summer of 1989. Our mother was in the hospital, and Deanna and her twin left the house one night and went to our grandmother's house and told our grandmother that our stepfather was abusing them. So when our mom got out of the hospital, a little bit after that, she went because after Deanna, told our grandmother, they basically stayed at our grandma's house and at our aunt's house, because they didn't want to send them back home. Our grandma didn't want to send them back home to their abuser. So they stayed at our grandma's and our aunt's house. And when our mom got out of the hospital, she went to go get them. And our grandma and our aunt weren't going to let them leave. They were, trying to protect them. And our mom called the cops, and the cops showed up and talked to our aunt. And our aunt said, "Look, these girls are being abused." So that's when the investigation began into our stepfather. And I remember being at home, and CPS, a lady from CPS, showed up and explained to my mom that while the investigation was going on, our stepfather couldn't be around us. So, she basically told our mom that Roy would have to leave the house or we would have to leave the house. And our mom basically chose for us to leave the house. And so we went to various relatives, and I don't remember exactly where everyone went. I know, our grandmother helped out, a couple aunts helped out, and our uncle helped out. But we were separated and went to various homes. And eventually, in October of 1989, Roy pled to his charges and, pled guilty and received 10 years probation and had to register as a sex offender for life. For whatever reason, after that happened, in the spring of 1990, I was allowed to return home. I don't know if my sisters were allowed to return home too and just chose not to, or, if they weren't allowed to return home, but I was at home, and our mom was still sick, and so kind of taking care of her, but also still a kid. And then my sisters were at various relatives still. So our oldest sister, during the summer of 1990, was going to Virginia to spend the summer with one of our aunts there. And so Deanna moved in with our grandmother, and her twin was staying with our uncle, which is, I would imagine, obviously, it was hard for all of us to be apart from each other, but for twins, especially hard. So on the evening of July 21st, 1990, Deanna stayed up late with our grandma watching movies. And then when our grandma went to bed, Deanna snuck out of the house to go see her twin. And she showed up at her, our uncle's house where her twin was staying, sometime around 3 or 3:30 in the morning, and knocked on her window. And they had a conversation, but it woke up our uncle. And so our uncle came out and told Deanna to get home. And Deanna left in a car, a brown car, with two men. And the next morning, our grandma woke up, and she decided, she was going to let Deanna sleep in a little bit since they had stayed up late watching movies. But at around 11 in the morning, she went to wake up Deanna, and she wasn't there. So she called around, to see if Deanna was at our house, my mom's house, and things, and she wasn't. So she filed a police report, and Deanna was filed as a runaway. So that was in 1990. And then in 1993, somebody called the police department and said that Deanna was back home. And so there was, they didn't look into that. They just, closed her case. And then our grandma found out somehow in 1995 and threw a fit and had them reopen the case. But because, well, what I've learned is basically because there was no new information, they almost immediately closed the case again. And so her case stayed closed, even though she wasn't home. And then in 2006, I started looking into things. I'll back up a little bit. Being at home, I was with my mom and my stepfather, and I was, told that Deanna just ran away. She left town, and that the abuse didn't happen, that it was, our grandma and our aunt just making trouble for the family. So those were the things I was raised believing. In 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, my husband was in the Air Force, and the Air Force asked, because we were on the Gulf Coast, the Air Force asked, if possible, if family can, go somewhere else while we get our infrastructure back, please do. So I went back to Central Texas. Most of Well, my sisters were living in, the Austin area and things like that. So I went back to a small town near there, and our stepdad was still in the picture. Our mom had passed away in 2002 from cirrhosis, but our stepdad was still around. And I'd let him stay over at our house at my house. Didn't think anything of it. I had two small children. And he would stay the night sometimes. And I found on my computer, which was a new computer, pornography, child pornography. And I confronted him immediately. And he told me that, yeah, he had been looking. And so I had him leave the house. And I haven't spoken to him since then. Just to protect my kids. And that got me questioning. Obviously, at that point, I realized the abuse happened. It's undeniable. But if my mom and my stepfather had lied to me about that, what else had they lied about? And so I started wondering about Deanna. And in 2007, I called the Colleen Police Department. And that's when I learned her case had been closed for, over 12 years. And so they reopened the case, and there was a detective there, Sergeant Davis, who, started working on her case and was talking to me and asking me things and talking to Deanna's twin and our grandma and things like that. And so, I figured there was some investigation. He was investigating it as though Deanna was still alive. And he talked to some of her friends, one of which claimed that Deanna had shown up at her house on the East Coast in the early 2000s. And that Deanna had had tattoos, but never wanted to be seen by family again. And, these tattoos were supposed to have our family name, Merrifield, and Texas, which is, I don't know, if I ever wanted to not be found by family, I would never get a tattoo with my last name and where I was from. But Sergeant Davis was of the belief, something's better than nothing. And so he kind of took that information and ran with it. And, it's been on a lot of her profiles and stuff like that. But I recently got to speak with this friend again, at the beginning of this year, and this friend claims that n no, none of that's true. She saw Deanna in a tattoo shop in Killeen one time, and Deanna told her she never wanted to be seen again. Also, n not a very believable story, because if Deanna was in Killeen, we would know. So the investigation at that point in 2007 was investigated as though Deanna was alive. Around 2010, things were getting quiet with the detective, and I was following up, but emails were going unanswered. But then in 2011, a new detective contacted me and wanted to speak to me. So, I went to Colleen and spoke to him, and he was investigating it as a homicide. So I was like, okay, as long as it's being investigated, let's do this. So I met with him, but then again, communication kind of quickly dropped off. And honestly, at that point, I was giving up, because there comes a time where you have to realize, I did social media and things like that in 2007. But I wasn't hearing from Deanna. So I began to realize that she probably wasn't alive. But the investigation was going nowhere. I wasn't getting any, responses from the police department. So yeah, that's basically where we were up until the beginning of this year. I went to a conference for family members of missing, and I was fired up and ready to go and ready to start advocating. And within a week of that conference, a new detective contacted me with the Killeen Police Department and was asking me questions. And we met in person, and he is not assigned Deanna's case. No one's really assigned Deanna's case. They don't have a cold case unit, but he is investigating Deanna's case whenever he doesn't have another case to work at that moment. So basically, in his off time, on the evenings and weekends, he investigates Deanna's case. And I've been hearing from him for 5 months now, and he's gotten more done for Deanna in 5 months than anyone else ever did. So that's basically where we're at.
Absolutely, and first of all, thank you for again taking the time, because I know this is not an easy thing to talk
Right.
about. And you've shared it, dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And I can't imagine how it feels every time you get asked a question like, who is Deanna? Because obviously you being a younger sister, there's a lot of time lapsed, right?
Right.
One of the things that I wanted to highlight is it took 17 years from
Right.
1990 to 2007 for police to take this, seriously. Can you walk through like that time in 2007, what it felt like to finally be, like heard? Because you and your family have been very like vocal, because there's a lot of questions that are unanswered.
Right.
You're like,
Right.
where the hell is Deanna? Like, who was she with? Where did she go? Like, it's those who, where, when, why, and how answers that oftentimes hurt the worst, right? Because these are questions that go unanswered, and 35 years later, still nothing. And a lot of
Right.
these cold cases, they get dropped into like a folder and they sit on these police departments' Either in their desk or in their office or whatever, they
In a
either,
box,
yeah, and they just sit on shelves as a cold case and they don't do a damn thing about it. And
That's true.
just walk me through, at that time, 2007, what it felt to finally be believed, to be heard, to be seen, and you've been very
So,
active on social media too. So walk me through that as well.
yeah. So, in 2007, I would say, yeah, it was good to feel to be seen, but also I don't like up until that point, I hadn't fully grasped exactly what had happened here. And if I'm being truthful, and I don't want to sound malicious or anything like that. I don't think there was malicious intent behind it. But if I'm being truthful, there was zero investigation in 1990. There was no search. There was no media. There were no flyers. Family didn't, organized searches or anything like that. So while it was so good to finally, see that there was this investigator that was doing something, in the back of my mind, I was still asking, why wasn't something done sooner? It led me to a lot of anger. And not just at the police department, but at family too. That's something I've just kind of had to work through. But yeah, it was good to see something being done, but also heartbreaking to know that up until that point, nothing had been done. Finally, like talking to the police department for the first time in 2007 made me realize that nothing had been done. And it's really easy for the police to brush a case like this aside if they don't have family constantly reaching out, asking what's being done, what's happening, and things like that. So yeah, it was frustrating, and I was very angry. And in 2007, social media, I've said it before, it was like the Wild West. And I had started, Facebook and MySpace and a couple of like sleuthing forums and things like that. And there were some really good ideas and some good guidance, but there was also, people who wanted to exploit Deanna in like, and I say exploit as in, I'll give you a psychic reading for $500, things like that. And then also just random, I didn't realize at the time, fake profiles, saying, yeah, she's dead in a ditch somewhere and stuff like that. So it was really 2007 social media, completely different than social media now. And I am so thankful for the social media we have now. And I know it's very harmful to a lot of people. It can still be very harmful to me if I'm on there too much. But it's still, as far as getting her story out there, it's more helpful now.
Absolutely. Do you think people are listening now more than ever? I mean, we have like these very high profile cases going on nationally. And whenever it comes to like social media, you're right, because that's how I found out about this story. That's how I connected with you, was through Instagram. And, sitting there and I get a notification of a new follower and it says finding Deanna. And I'm thinking, why are we trying to find Deanna? Because that's one of those things that just pops in your head, because you think like, okay, this account followed me, but this is obviously something that's very deep and personal to somebody. So, I scroll through social media and you're sharing pictures of Deanna, from childhood, right? And there's several pictures, her holding up like a elephant
Your
Right.
ass, like your muzzle.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And looking at these pictures, I can't help but just feel. I can't even get to tell you how I feel about it. I'm not the one going through this, right? Because that's not my story. But I still feel connected to it in a way because, as a survivor of sexual assault, domestic violence myself, I know what it feels like to not be believed. I know what it feels like to not be seen. I know what it feels like to not be heard. And, part of the reason we've created this podcast is for stories exactly like Deanna's and yours and, the other Deannas that are out there right now, because there's a lot of missing people. There's a lot of cases that just go cold. And, it's like police don't get any leads and they're like, well, that's it. That's the end of that. It's going to go in a box and it's going to sit there for literally years. And it just, you grew up in outside of or in Killeen, Texas, just outside of Fort Hood. And reading like the findingdeanna.com website, I can't help but lose my train of thought because there's a lot to it. This is a very complex story. And being in 1990, you mentioned during our pre-interview that the state of Texas didn't investigate quote unquote runaway cases at that point.
And actually, the Killeen Police Department, I've spoken to them, and even now, there are so many runaway cases reported that, from what they've said, they can't possibly investigate all of them because a lot of them, they run away for a day or whatever. My issue is, if a child goes missing, it doesn't matter if they chose to go missing or not. Even if they decided to run away with their friends, there's somebody involved in that situation that is either helping a child run away, which is not okay because normal good people don't do that, or the child is running away from a situation that isn't good. So if a child is missing, we need to just throw away the runaway label and call them what they are. They're a missing child. So yeah, it's frustrating. And yeah, even now they still don't investigate those cases like immediately. It's unfortunate. But yeah.
Have you been in contact with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children?
Yes.
How did
So
that interaction go?
we started working with them in 2007, and they've actually, they've done some age progressions. They've received some leads that they pass along to local law enforcement for them to investigate. And yeah, so I would say, it's good for getting those age progressions and things like that out there that could potentially help. Going on the assumption that she is still alive. Yeah, so it's been pretty good. And this summer to mark the 35th year that Deanna has been missing, Patty Davis did an article for her on the NTMAC blog.
Which is incredible, and thinking about it, just based on doing like some research about National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, I remember growing up hearing about the story of Adam Walsh and or John Walsh and turning his rage into, helping families find the answers that they've always been, that they've been searching for. And you can go to Google and you can type in missing children statistics like I'm doing at this very moment. And in 2024, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC, assisted with 29,568 missing children reports, achieving a 91% recovery rate for these cases, while the FBI's National Crime Information Center, NCIC, recorded 349,557 missing person reports involving youth. Runaway cases constituted the majority of NCMEC reports, but there were also significant numbers of children missing from foster or state care, which is obviously something that is obviously very overlooked because, we're supposed to trust these, we're supposed to trust these systems, and we're supposed to trust that they're going to, help our children instead of failing them. And police departments are a part of that system, and whenever the system fails, it all fails. And whenever we have trafficking and sex trafficking and sextortion still going rampant in our communities, by there's just so many things to tackle. And this is a very complex, case with Deanna, and I don't want to deflect from that. I want to continue, amplifying, the work that you are doing to get those answers that you rightfully deserve. And I can't imagine what it feels like 35 years since this happened. Like, I cannot begin to explain how I feel about it. And that's just me listening to, you share your story. And I would like to kind of do a deep dive into when you started noticing, because you mentioned about her being sexually abused. When did you start noticing different signs, like different, because they always say, like, you see something, say something, and good touch versus bad touch. Can you walk through what that was like for you to hear for the first time, and like just walk us through that really quick?
For me, I don't think I noticed the signs. I was younger than her. And I don't think I fully understood what was going on. I did notice, she was starting to listen to, like, when we were little, like, she liked Madonna and Janet Jackson, and she liked making her own dances and things like that. As we got older, she started listening to, like, Ozzy Osbourne and heavy metal and things, but I didn't see that as a sign. I saw that as her becoming a teenager, I will say I talked to one of her other friends recently, and she said, yeah, you could tell Deanna was changing. And this friend actually asked her what was going on, what's happening, why are you changing? Because, her friend said she was becoming quieter and hanging out with a different group. So I didn't see it. I think her friends saw it, and I think there were other adults who probably saw the changes and, for whatever reason, either didn't realize or didn't do anything about it. But yeah, I think the signs were there. The signs were there for all of us. The behaviors, whether it be sexual abuse or just, the trauma that was going on at home, because it wasn't a stable home. Our mom, I don't know if she was just a I don't know if she was in remission or if she was just a functioning alcoholic, but for a while there, our mom was a great mom. And she would bake cookies and she would throw popcorn parties and things like that. But then there was, like, this steep decline where things got crazy. I remember sitting out on the curb at our house while our mom and our stepdad fought inside the house. I still to this day have no idea what they were fighting about, but it sounded like a knockdown drag out fight. And we're just sitting on the curb for hours while this happens. And, there was a decline there. And I think the signs were there for that something was going on at home. And either people weren't educated enough to know what was probably happening, or people just it was they still had that what goes on the home on in the home stays in the home vibe back then, at least there. And so I don't know, but things should have been done a lot sooner than they were. And so yeah, the signs were there, and I think that for me it still didn't click, but I knew things were chaotic, and I don't know, just to look back as an adult now, and to imagine this 13-year-old child having the courage to say that this is going on, this is happening, it doesn't feel right, I need help, can somebody help me because this is wrong. And then to go through all of that, and then to be removed from your home and be taken, removed from your sisters and removed from your mom, and have to basically couch surf as a 13-year-old child. And then to see your perpetrator and get 10 years probation and carry on with his life as though nothing was happening. Is I just can't imagine what that must have felt like for a 13-year-old child. I mean, who was punished there?
And see, that's another one of the questions that still lingers and it still hangs around. And it's on the top of mind every time that we think about this case. And I just can't help but think, what was going through her mind? What was she thinking? And I feel so connected to this case for some reason. I think it's just because of how complex it is, and it's just fascinating to kind of like, just to learn. I grew up on true crime, so I can listen to stories and I just feel connected to it, and I find parts that I connect to the person. As again, as a survivor, I feel connected to this case. Can you talk really quickly about your earliest memory of Deanna?
So my earliest memory is hard, but I remember watching She-Ra over at one of our friends' houses, which was really cool because they also had a lot of siblings. So, everybody got along with everybody. And then I remember playing restaurant was one of our favorite things to do. Our mom never woke up with us in the mornings, and definitely not on the weekends. And so sometimes all four of us would get together and we would play restaurant, and one of us would be the cook and one of us would be the waitress, and then the other two would be the diners. And of course the menu would only be like toast or cereal or whatever we had at the time. But that was one of my favorite things to do with the four of us was play restaurant.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of us enjoyed playing restaurant as a child. I remember having like this McDonald's themed like type, structure type thing, right? And I remember, gosh, a lot of my childhood is kind of a blur to me. I grew up
Yeah,
with an
same.
absent biological father, but at the same time, again, I relate to Deanna in certain ways because I wasn't bullied either. And I know what went through my mind, and I can't even imagine what went through her mind, at that time. So one of the other questions that I had, what are you doing to continue sharing Deanna's voice? And how can people, amplify Deanna's story? You're very active on social media, Facebook, Instagram, with Finding Deanna. What do you think by reaching out on social media more heavily, doing these podcast interviews, reaching out to news media, and what are your hopes for this new detective to uncover? Because you stated that he's working on the case whenever, obviously there's a lot of things going on across the country in a lot of these cases, but whenever he's not working on that case, what do you hope to uncover?
So, as far as hope for Deanna's case, my biggest hope is to find her. It's sad that I can't hope to find her alive, but I think realistically speaking, that's just not the case anymore. So now, in order for me personally to keep hope alive, I have to just hope that she's found so that Deanna can have peace. And so that her, not just myself, but all of our family can have peace. And then, as far as what I'm doing, media pressure works. And it's clear that Deanna's story, for, whatever reason, isn't worthy of mainstream media. But I still believe that media pressure works. And I think that we are very, very extremely lucky to have a detective on the case right now who's doing things for her. But I also know that that can change at the drop of a hat. And so for me, we have to keep up the media pressure to let the police department know that there are eyes on them and that people want to know what happened to Deanna. So I keep talking as loudly as I possibly can, as much as I possibly can, about Deanna's case, because I've seen in the past that the moment I stop talking, things stop being done.
And it should not be like that, right?
Shouldn't.
Because these systems were supposedly designed to help us, but in the end, it seems like they were designed to do more harm than there is good. And you can't help but think that the police have sat with us for 17 years, because I don't know how they sleep at night, if I'm being fully honest and being fully transparent. I honestly don't. And if they're doing this to, if they did this to Deanna, how many other cases are there out there that are still not being told, or not being talked about, and these stories are not being told? Because again, going back to thinking about mainstream media, what do we see on mainstream media? We see a lot of like politics. Yes, it's still deeply important. At the same time, we have literal people dying in our streets at the hands of a perpetrator. Sexual assault is high, and domestic violence is high, and gun violence. And still, these systematic failures continue to exist. And we have politicians that do not want to listen to our voices, do not want to listen to our experiences, because it doesn't fit their narrative, because they don't care, they don't believe us. And oftentimes survivors get asked the question of, well, what were you wearing? Or, who were you with? And the actuality, it really doesn't fucking matter what somebody's wearing. I mean, listen to their story. They're trying to tell you something that happened to them. Believe them. So start by believing, and that's the reality of it. And I think back to some of the other cases that I've, read about and that I've learned about, and there's a lot of connecting pieces, and learning about some other cases, that were in that same area. There's just some very deep, dark trouble that happened in that area, right? Like, not even just in 1990, but even before that, and like after that, because there was other cases, and I found a Reddit thread on Grateful Doe from 4 months ago. And I don't want to go off assumption, but I believe this was your posting or somebody else's posting, because if not, they know a lot about the case. And just reading these comments on here and just everybody's asking like these questions, it's always aggravating how many Doe stories get blocked by cops simply not wanting to do their job or being extremely bad at it. America's finest, I suppose. Somebody said, "I'm also in Killeen as a female alone, except two kids under 10 in the house. I got up to let my dog out at 3 a.m. and saw my very elderly neighbor's gate to her fence and her front door were wide open. Since never in the 10 years I've lived here has she had it either open. I was suspicious, but didn't want to go investigate, leave my own house and kids in it. Called the cops, who refused to come check and scolded me for not having her phone number or going myself. They're extra unwilling to help, I swear. They also knocked on the front door once and handed my 15-year-old the neighbor's infant to hold until someone came to get it. No info taken from her, and we didn't know the new renters. Frigging awful. Can you from your perspective, what do you think about that?
So here's the thing. It's in, I think it was April or May of this year, the Killeen Police Department had a town hall. I think it was May. They had a town hall where they were talking about, all the technology that they're using now, talking about funding, things like that. And at that point, including the new recruits, which obviously some of them will end up not going on to be police officers, but at that point, they were overstaffed by seven people. So the running excuse I've always heard when it comes to these police departments not being able to do their job correctly is we're understaffed. We don't have the budget, things like that. And then to sit there and hear them say that they're actually overstaffed, like it's a bragging point. And to know that even though they're overstaffed, they can't assign officially a detective to my sister's case is infuriating. And it's not just Deanna's case. When I went to the advocacy conference at the beginning of this year in March, it was the first time I had ever been to something like that. And it was so good for my heart to be able to connect with other families who were going through the same thing that I'm going through. But on the other hand, why the hell are there so many families going through the exact same thing that we're going through? It's not one police department. It's not one town or one state. It is everywhere. Everywhere. These cases are being ignored and the ball is being dropped. And there is absolutely no excuse for it at this point, especially if your department is overstaffed.
Based on doing a really quick research on Killeen, Texas, the Killeen Police Department is 335 member organization with 265 members allotted sworn length. We are responsible, and this is directly on the Killeen, Texas website on the police department. We are responsible for all police functions in Killeen, Texas, a city of 156,261 population covering 55.235 square miles. My thing is, if there's that many officers, do your goddamn job. That is the absolute bullshit reason that they gave you, is they're understaffed. Because based on doing research on the budget, the city adopted a 315.0 million overall budget for fiscal year 2025 with a general fund of 125.7. That is absolute bullshit.
If you run some numbers on that, I've known teachers that have more students than those cops have citizens to protect.
And that's it. True. That's the reality of it. And again, going, looking at this and thinking, because, millions of dollars for a police department is absolutely insane to me anyway. Like, I get it. I understand. They have like general funds, they pay wages, they do things like that. But at the same time, a lot of these programs that are also in the communities get defunded and money gets more allocated to these police departments for them to do what exactly? And this isn't me saying that all police are bad. This isn't me saying that. This is just me saying that if you're going to take citizens' taxes, do something with that and help these families. Do not just let these answers, these questions go unanswered. Do your damn job. And I live in Kansas City, and thinking about how we do not have local control over our police department, the police department is controlled by a board that is somewhat appointed by the city, but also appointed by the governor, and the governor has overall say. A governor should not have control of a police department because, respectfully, that governor is not competent enough to handle police department. I mean, we're talking about Missouri here. That would be like putting Greg Abbott in charge of a police department. That wouldn't go over very well, right? But thinking about this overall budgeting and thinking about everything, and a lot of these police departments receive 80% or a little less or a little more of the city's annual budget. There should not be such a thing as a cold case. There should not be such a thing as a rape kit backlog. There should not be anything as any type of injustice, because the way that the system is set up right now, it's literally you are guilty until you're found innocent. It's supposed to be you're innocent until proven guilty, not anymore. And that's the reality of it. And it's been like that for decades. It's been like that for a very, very long time. And is there anything out there that you would like to, to continue sharing? Anything else about Deanna that you want people to know about? Or what? And my last question to you, and we'll wrap up, is if there's another family that's listening to this that may be going through something similar, what would you tell them? Or just a family that's starting out on this journey of trying to find these answers, what would be your best advice to them? And how can people reach out to you? How can people amplify your message? Just walk us through that last part right there.
So, to families who are going through this, it is a lot of people forget that this is, at least for me personally, the worst thing that ever happened in my life. So, I think families need to keep that and protect that and be careful about. Thank goodness for you, because you are, there's a difference between ethical podcasting and, just podcasting. So guard your loved one's story, and try to stick with ethical podcasts, but you have to tell their story. And is it exhausting? Yes. But it needs to be done, because you have to keep that pressure on your police department. And part of that is telling your loved one's story. So get loud, and get loud in social media, get loud with mainstream media if you're blessed enough to have it, and get loud with the police department. You don't have to be disrespectful to be loud. But you need to make sure that their story is heard, and you need to keep telling that story, because the moment you stop telling it, there's no one else to do it. Nobody else is going to do it, unfortunately. So just keep the pressure on is what I would say to family. You can't just expect people to do their jobs. Because nobody's perfect, and nobody is just going to go in and give 110% every single day. I'm thankful for the detective that we have now. It disgusts me beyond measure that he has to do this in his off time. That man should not have to work overtime unpaid just because he cares about my sister. As far as like sharing Deanna's story, again, I want to continue telling her story. Her story deserves to be heard. She deserves so much better than what she was given. And she still deserves better now because she deserves to be found. She deserves to be at peace. So I want to keep telling her story. I want people to please share her story as much as possible. And if they want to reach me, they can reach me at missy@findingdeanna.com, or they can reach me on our social medias, Finding Deanna.
Perfect. Melissa, seriously, I thank you with everything in me for, coming on the podcast and also sharing Deanna's story, but also your passion to help other families. You've been amplifying other family stories as well on your social
Absolutely.
media because you found this community that nobody wanted to be a part of. Because this isn't
Right.
something that you asked for. This isn't something that anybody in their right mind would ask for. But you share her story and you keep her name alive. And even though there's a
Absolutely.
lot of unanswered questions, I think that's what it comes down to is, continue amplifying, continue sharing, because hopefully there's a break in the story. It sounds like you have a really good detective on this case now. And I send all my best to you and to the rest of your family who are still, asking these questions as to what the hell happened to Field. And that's
Yeah.
actually going to be the name of this podcast episode, is What the Hell Happened to Deanna Merrifield? Because this is something that a lot of us are asking, and I doing research on this case, there's not a lot of public information. And what I mean by that is there's not a lot of news articles, there's not a lot
Right.
of really anything, really. And
Right.
that's deeply devastating.
Yeah.
Because how do we find out things? We do Google searches, we do social media searches, other than things that you've written. I mean, if you go in and type in Deanna Merrifield in recent, recent news articles, you find a couple, but other than that, there's not a
Right.
lot.
Yeah. There isn't a lot. We do reach out to, especially, when we had the candlelight vigil, we did a press release to all local news there, and only the Killeen Daily Herald showed up. And I don't, they're not going to tell her story, so I have to.
And it really shouldn't be your responsibility to share that story. You know what I mean? Like, oh gosh, I can't even imagine. I really can't. I cannot imagine what goes through your mind every time you tell the story because I'm living through it. I'm listening to this and I'm seeing it and I'm just speechless.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love talking about Deanna. I much prefer talking about, when things were good and we were happy. But it's weird because as an adult now, I still see her as a child, and she's supposed to be my big sister, but she could be my child. In my brain now, that could be my 13-year-old child. And it's really kind of surreal because I do have a daughter that's an adult now. And so just watching her grow up, and it kind of forces you to think about what Deanna could have been had she been given the basic right, I don't know, basic human rights, basically, basic protection, a basic childhood. I just can't imagine what she could have been.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. And I know there's going to be somebody that's going to be listening to this that's going to feel connected to the story. And we remain committed to telling stories like this because these are stories that deserve to be heard. These are stories that deserve to be on the national headlines. And, you know, these massive like investigations, right? Because we see cases like Gabby Petito, for example, had like a really massive following, massive blogger, and we see it on these headlines. And I'm not discrediting her story because her story was deeply heartbreaking. Her story was, you know, it deserved to be told and still deserves to be told because they still don't know what the hell happened, right? But at the same time, there's cases like Deanna's that did not get that massive attention, did not get this national search, did not get jack shit, to be fully honest.
And I, you know, I'm as much as I want to be angry that there are so many of us whose loved ones went missing and didn't get these huge searches, I'm just thankful for the ones that are getting those searches. I wish everybody could, but thank God some of them are, I guess. And it's hard because I have to make a conscious choice to. I've learned anger doesn't get me anywhere in this case. Yeah, I'll be angry, but it kind of paralyzes me too and causes me to, not be as helpful as I could be. So I have to put my anger aside and just, you know, be thankful that there are Gabby Petitos out there who did get the attention that they deserved and that was needed. And thank God that they're bringing light to domestic violence and, you know, keep pushing so that everybody can get that.
Absolutely. Melissa, thank you again. I keep saying this. And
Thank you so much.
I keep saying we're gonna wrap up and then I ask another question. So to anybody out there who is listening, please continue amplifying Deanna Merrifield's story because this is a story that deserves to be told. This is a story, you know, there's a lot of
And they
Gabby.
all do.
Yes,
They all
absolutely.
do.
There's a lot of Gabby Petitos, there's a lot of Deanna Merrifields. There's a lot of, you know, horrid cases that I've been doing a deep dive into as a true crime person and somebody who loves storytelling and, you know, somebody who loves like horror films too. Like, this is right up my alley to continue sharing stories like this. But thank you for coming on to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being able to share Deanna's story, and especially with somebody who gets it.
It makes it all worth it, right? Because it's very hard to find somebody who actually genuinely cares and actually genuinely will sit and listen and not interrupt you while you're talking. I listen to a lot of like true crime podcasts. I listen to a lot of interviews and they cut people off in the middle of a sentence. And I just don't believe in that. I believe in having those authentic conversations because ultimately that's what we need to do. And these are conversations that we need to be had because if we're not going to talk about it, who the hell's going to? Who can we rely on? I mean, look what happens. You mentioned it earlier whenever you talked about if you stop talking about it, it's going to go cold. And it will because nobody's talking about it.
And I think it's very easy for law enforcement and just, I mean, basically any organization to be like, well, if they don't care, why should we? And I think that's it happens far too often.
Absolutely, I agree.
Never mind that they're being paid, literally paid to care, but
All right, Melissa, thank you so much. And anybody out there listening, you can find Melissa on social media. at Finding Deanna. You can also go to findingdeanna.com and find out more information about this case. Melissa, thank you so much, and we will talk to you very soon.
Okay, thank you.